Welcome to the Faith Debate on News Radio 930 WFMD. I'm Troy Skinner. Thanks so much for listening. Joined this week by Daniel Rasby. He's one of the co-pastors at the church that meets at Imran's house. You can learn more about them online at conqueredbylove.org. And I think I said my website, but just in case I didn't, it's householdoffaithinchrist.com. We've been spending the last number of weeks, like three, 4 weeks, something like that, talking about things that have to do with pastors and elders and the requirements and the responsibilities of and the role of men and women in those sorts of things. And David Forsey was here to talk about those things with Daniel and I, and we're kind of continuing some of those thoughts now without David. So good, we can talk about it. We would never talk about him behind his back.
Not in a bad way, anyway.
No, exactly. If we're going to ridicule him, we want him to hear the ridicule, right?
Exactly.
That's half the fun. So this week, I still want us to talk about pastors, but we're going to pivot in a moment. But to finish up the thing about whether pastors need to be men who are married or what have you, assuming that a man could be unmarried and be a pastor, can that person have been divorced before they became a Christian? So let's say somebody gets married when they're 18, they get divorced when they're 19, they have a conversion experience when they're 20, and now they want to be a pastor when they're 40.
I think the answer doesn't really depend on whether they have to be married now to be a pastor, because you could say, let's say they're remarried.
Okay, and they've remarried. Okay, that takes that off the table completely. The point, because I would say that if somebody has been a believer, right, they identify as a believer, everybody says, yeah, they're a believer, and then they have an unbiblical divorce, okay, well, you clearly can't be a pastor. I'm not even sure about your faith at this point, right, if you're going to disobey God's word overtly. But if it's an indiscretion like that, before and they even...
I would say, I mean, your life before you're a believer kind of doesn't exist. I mean, Paul was a murderer.
Yeah.
Quite literally.
Yeah.
He bore false witness and was a murderer, and kidnapper and man stealer and all those things. But Paul is probably a bad example, because we had this discussion a couple weeks ago about whether he's even qualified to be an elder, because he was not married, at least at the time he was writing the letters. But I think that's a good example of what you did before doesn't impact how you can be used for God's kingdom now. It may have earthly consequences, right? You know, you may have committed a crime and now you're in jail for it. Just because you get saved doesn't mean you should be let out of jail necessarily. Although jail might be a bad example, because we talked about before, I don't agree with the idea of jail. I think restitution is much better than incarceration. So that's what I would say about that. I think if you're married, if you were divorced or something before you were saved, that may not be the same thing. Now, the prohibitions still apply. Let's say now you're married to some other woman, and then later you get divorced to that woman. Let's even say it's a biblical divorce. If there is such a thing, not all believers would agree there is such a thing as a biblical divorce, but assuming there is, you can't go back to that first wife, even if she's now a Christian, because I think the Bible is very clear, don't go back to the original wife if you've had two. But maybe, you know, other people would say, well, that's just an Old Testament prohibition and whatever else, but...
Yeah,
there are pastors. There's quite a big group, especially in the Mennonite community, that would say if you've ever been divorced, you can't ever be remarried, no matter whether it was a quote unquote biblical divorce or not. Not only can that you can't even be a member of the church if you're currently married to somebody that's not your first wife. You need to separate and not be with them in order to be a member of the church. So let alone a pastor.
Yeah, that's why I'm not a Mennonite. One of the reasons. Yeah, that's a bit of a hyper precise application. We were talking about the regulative principle last week, right? That's a hyper regulative principle on the marriage question and the church membership question. Like, if you can never have ever been divorced, even if it's, well, I don't know if Mennonites even think there is a certain Mennonites would say that there is no such thing as biblical divorce. Is there?
I think they may be okay with that. It's more the remarriage that they're not.
Gotcha. Okay.
I think in certain situations, such as adultery, maybe abuse, but circumstances of abuse, a lot of them would probably say just separation is the answer, not divorce. That you can't just go up and get married to somebody else now. You have made a vow to be married. And if you're fearing for your life, that's one thing, but that doesn't just give you the liberty to go marry somebody else. That's the teaching that I've heard before. And I'm not Mennonite either, so we probably should have a Mennonite pastor right. to defend himself right. on this. But there is a large portion of the church that is extremely strict on the divorce and remarriage topic. I think I'm not quite as much there, but I don't believe, as many Christians seem to, that you can just go divorce willy-nilly, get remarried, and there's no consequences for that or no church discipline for that.
Yeah, and
I just think the solution, once you repent of it, is not necessarily to now tear apart this new family with the new kids you have. I don't know that that's really the solution for it. I think
yeah, there's a lot of wisdom questions to navigate those sorts of things, but, you know, I don't want to turn this into a sermon because this isn't, you know, that's not what the faith debate is here for, but I think a strong word needs to be reinforced here because I'm agreeing with almost everything I think I heard Daniel just say, so we're on the same page, but I know that you might be listening to what Daniel just said and you disagree. And I had a conversation with a good friend of mine not too long ago who's apparently having some dissatisfaction in his marriage. And it's not like they're at each other's throats. As best as I can tell, they're not cheating on one another. Like, there's nothing like that. But they've, you know, the whole we've grown apart story that you hear. You know, it's not what we thought. And, you know, we've been married a number of years now. We're not in love like we were. And so, you know, we're not happy together. And so I think it's best if we just get divorced. And, you know, I'm not sure if he was sharing it with me because he wanted counsel or if he was sharing because he was just sharing life. I don't know. But he got some counsel. He got an earful of counsel. I said, are you kidding me? You want to turn your wife into a whore? Mm-hmm. Because if she ever wants to then go get remarried to somebody else, she's an adulteress. Right? You're gonna consign her to a life of singleness for the rest of her life because you want to get out of the marriage?
Not only that, but, oh, I don't feel like I'm in love. Well, tough. God commanded husbands, love your wives. Not if you want to, if you feel like it, if you're in love. Love your wives. That's what it says. Husbands, love your wives. You are commanded to love your wife. It doesn't matter whether she deserves the love or not. You have to love her.
And we have such with her. A squishy understanding of what love even means. Certainly, I think love can embody some emotional response and that warm, fuzzy feeling. I think that it can be an aspect of what it is to have love for someone, to have a deep felt affection for someone. But that's not all that love is. I would argue that's not even primarily what love is. Primarily, I think love should be understood as a verb. It's about what you do. Go love your wife, meaning go care for your wife, protect your wife, provide for your wife, defend your wife and her honor. Hey, do things that are going to help your wife to grow in the Lord. It's about what you do. It's not about what you feel. The whole feeling thing, that's Freudian. That's not biblical, right? That's that's about...
That's lust, not love.
Yeah, it's about the psychobabble stuff that has dominated the culture for the last 100-plus years now. But that's not the biblical thing. So, yeah, and that's why it's possible. When God gives you a command and says, love your wife, how am I going to manufacture those feelings? It's not about the feelings. It's about serving your wife. And you know what? The feelings will come, mm-hmm. right? If you actively, it's like the movie, you ever see the movie Fireproof? Mm-hmm. You know, Kirk Cameron's in it, and I think it's a pretty good movie. It's not award-winning, but it's a pretty good movie. But the Kirk Cameron character does not love his wife when the story starts.
Right.
His father basically tells him, I mean, I'm short-circuiting the narrative of the story, but basically his father says, tough cookies, son. Do these things for 40 days. Go love your wife for 40 days. And so he does things that are demonstrating love for his wife. And early on, he has no interest in doing it. But by the end, he wants to do them. And guess what? Lo and behold, he actually has those warm fuzzies. Mm-hmm. Right? The emotion will follow the action.
Right. So going back to then the divorce and remarriage, the controversy among pastors seems to be on that teaching from Jesus that says, whoever divorces his wife except for adultery causes her to become an adulteress, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. And so there is the question, first of all, is there a double standard for marrying a divorced woman versus a divorced man? Because it only says whoever is marrying a divorced woman commits adultery. But I don't know. The the specific mincing the words, I know people that will say, well, clearly this means you could divorce because of adultery. And the other people will say, well, no, even for adultery, it doesn't say that. It says if you're divorcing for some reason other than adultery, then you're causing her to become an adulteress. But if you're divorcing for adultery, she's already an adulteress. That's why not causing her to become an adulteress. So that's what they would say. And then the understanding would be, no, actually, you just really shouldn't ever get divorced for any reason at all. I would take the tack that it is allowable but not preferred to divorce in a cases of infidelity. And as David said last week, I think he used the word ideal or optimal. I think it's optimal or ideal to still remain married if possible and reconcile. And in cases of other cases that seem extreme or unhealthy or awful, such as abuse and so on, other things, there are remedies that don't involve actual divorce. There's separation and so on, and counseling and reconciliation, hopefully at some day, if that's possible. But that's kind of...
Yeah, and we're pretty much on the same page. Particularly in a culture like ours, where it's so normal for people not just to get divorced once, get divorced a whole bunch of times.
Regardless of religious affiliation, it seems like.
Now, this might become a decreasing problem because nobody's getting married anymore, but... As long as people are getting married, divorce is a problem. And, you know, when I put a couple through my, premarital counseling sessions, I emphatically tell them that divorce is not an option.
No.
I say it's mostly for rhetorical effect because I do believe biblically that divorce can be an option. But I want them to understand divorce is not an option. Divorce does not exist in your vocabulary. You start having a fight, and you don't say, well, fine, let's just get divorced. Like, those words don't leave your mouth. Those thoughts don't enter your head. Those attitudes are not part of your heart. Like, divorce is not an option until maybe someday, because everything conspired against your marriage, you now have to talk to your pastor about, I think my marriage is over. And, okay, now we have to talk about divorce. But even then, I would say the overwhelming majority of the time, the marriage can... And should, well, it should be, but can be rescued. Mm-hmm. So some people, oh, he or she cheated on me, so now I'm going to get divorced, as though like that's the automatic must be response, right?
It's your get out of jail free card.
No. There are incredibly wonderful marriages today that are post adulterous liaisons, right? The husband or the wife cheated on their spouse, and they worked through it, and now you look at that marriage decades later, oftentimes. And it's like a picture-perfect marriage, as far as you can tell. Like, from a distance, it's like they have an ideal marriage, and in many ways, they do. Like, there is recovery from that. Mm-hmm. The other thing you haven't mentioned is, the whole separation, like the abandonment question. If somebody abandons their, some people would argue that if an unbeliever abandons because you become a believer, but some would argue that there's different kinds of infidelity that represent an abandonment.
Like having another family, for example.
Like a husband who's just, having that'd be a really good one. Or a husband who, or a wife, I guess. And usually it's the husband, because they're bigger and stronger often, most often, who's just battering his spouse nearly to within an inch of her life. Yeah. Or just making her life, quote unquote, a living hell, because he just, he hates his wife and he wants her to know it. And he's going to make her life as miserable as absolutely possible. And some would argue, and I take this on a case-by-case basis, so I don't have a blanket answer on this. Mm-hmm. But if that's legitimately, after sussing it out and doing your investigation on things, and that's really what's going on, has the person abandoned the marriage? Has the person, in effect, committed some sort of an adultery? Not a sexual adultery, but some sort of a relational adultery by embracing something that's not godly, not benefiting the marriage. If it's dramatic enough, I've had to deal with this when I was not the pastor, but was a pastor at a church where there was somebody else who was the pastor, and we had to navigate this question together as a team, like, what do we do? And full disclosure, for this conversation, we ended up deciding that in this case, it was the woman who needed rescue, in our opinion. And we said, you know what? God help us, literally. I hope we're making the right call here, but we feel like we can honor your decision to move forward with a divorce with your husband. We think that God would sanction it. to this day, I'm not 100% sure I was right. But I, or that we as a group,
I would
right.
definitely have a lot more grace for somebody who's being physically abused.
Yeah.
Rather than emotionally or with words. Not that words have no effect. But
now, when I say I'm not 100% sure, just for the record, I'm 99% sure.
Sure.
You know, I don't. I'm not wrestling at night like, oh, I'm. But there's just every once in a while there's a twinge of doubt because it's that serious. Divorce, and that's the point I'm trying to emphasize. That divorce is that serious. And it sounds like you agree with me. All right, so we've got time to talk about the one last thing that I think I really want us to have time to talk about when we were talking about pastors. The divorce and remarriage thing was related to that, but mostly it was going to be about divorce and remarriage with pastors and stuff. And we've covered that here and there in spots over the course of the last handful of shows that I don't think we need to beat that horse anymore. So one more thing I wanted to talk about regarding pastors specifically, and this is an issue that you see a lot with the YouTubers and a lot of social media comments and stuff. A lot of pastors get called to task for the tone that they take or the tone that they don't take. So how important would you say tone is for a pastor? And by tone, do you need me to define what I mean? Do you think the listener would benefit from me defining what I mean?
Probably a little more explanation would be helpful, another sentence or two.
So some guys are, they're the manly men, burly, right? And they're aggressive in their attitude and even their word choice and their manner. It's very aggressive and they're going to call out sin and they're going to call it out sharply.
And fire and brimstone type of thing.
And that's toxic masculinity, and that's unbecoming a Christian. And so you're too aggressive, you're too mean-spirited, that you're not loving. So there's that. But then there are others who will criticize other pastors who are, and they get criticized for, you're trying too hard to be winsome. You know, you're soft and you're light in your
like
loafers.
Like a TV pastor.
Yeah, yeah. You're
like somebody on.
You're like
on
Mr. Rogers wearing a little sweater up on there, and you're not willing to call out sin, and you're always, you know, circumventing the issues by dancing around it and nuancing things to death. And sometimes you just got to bring it.
So there's also pastors that get caught out for having a mocking tone.
Yeah.
And not really exhorting. I mean, they may have a lot of great stuff to say, but they have too many jokes and stuff. And either it comes across as mocking or flippant. And so then there's some criticism there.
So how important is tone? Are there any tones, now that we've defined them a bit, that are off limits for a pastor and therefore off limits for a Christian, I would argue? Or is it case by case? Is it does the environment and the circumstances that are presenting,
I think the,
come into play?
I would think the environment makes a difference. The context makes a difference. Certainly, sin should be called out when it needs to be called out. But there's also times, and with the leading of the Spirit, you might have a time of having a soft answer to turn away wrath, or to turn over tables like Jesus did as well. I think both of those are the place of the Christian in different times and contexts, and also personality has a way. It has something to do with it. You know, if you are not of the personality, if you're more an introverted personality, but God's called you to teach, there could be some things in some ways. You don't have to all of a sudden try to become really animated and powerful and all this. It may be that God's called you for a specific purpose and to teach in a certain way. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think being unnecessarily crass or rude or obnoxious type of thing when you're speaking and maybe cursing and stuff like that is probably not so becoming. But you could also make the argument that Jesus used some language that would be bleeped in most TV or radio shows today. I mean, he would go around saying things like, "You son of a snake," which we have a similar phrase in American English, which is considered a curse, he goes around calling his chosen people a whore all the time, this deservedly so at that time when they were not following God, and they got, so I don't think that you can really say, definitively, this is not a good pastor because he doesn't use the tone I appreciate. I don't know. I think much more can be gained usually by cleaner language. So I'm not advocating for people to go around cursing, but I also don't know that's going to mean that they're not a good pastor, or not saved, or anything like that.
Yeah, we don't want to have unwholesome talk coming out of our mouths, it says in the New Testament. Paul says that. I think it's in Ephesians, if my memory serves. I couldn't give you the exact chapter and verse right now off the top of my head.
And I think in King James it says no corrupt communication, right? Curse proceeded out of your mouth.
However, how are we defining what we mean by whether your translation into the English is corrupt or unwholesome? What are we meaning there? And I think there's a strong argument made that it's talking about something that's unedifying and unhelpful, right, for that person or those people in those situations. There are times when, think about it as a parent.
Or ungodly in general.
Right, but think about it as a parent. There are times when you're going to use what some people consider to be a harsh tone with your children. And other times you're going to use a very gentle, sing-songy, baby talk kind of a tone. Both of those are appropriate.
Maybe with the same child or with a different child because it was appropriate in the context and to the person you're giving the message to.
Now, if you need to arrest your child's attention because they're about to get hit by a Mack truck, you're not going to say, oh, my lovey-dovey little son or daughter, let's be safe now. And then they get hit by the Mack truck because there was no urgency in your tone. But if you need to remind them to brush their teeth, you don't, instead of saying, hey, honey, it's time for bed, go brush your teeth, it's like, honey, it's time for bed, go brush your teeth. It's like, okay, like, the tone has to match the moment. That's not situational ethics, right? It's applied wisdom. There are times when, so I would argue that for me, somebody being rather brash, coming across as, arguably harsh, is totally appropriate. And even more than fine, it's the way to go because it's the most loving approach to take for that person or that group of people in that particular context. But there are other times when those same people, so it's not always the people, those same people, but in a slightly different situation, you're going to use a softer, more winsome tone. But I would agree with you. I think the default should be to try to be gentle, because that's the fruit of the Spirit. It's about gentleness and kindness and self-control, right? And so if you're going to be bombastic all the time, are you being bombastic for effect? Are you being bombastic strategically? Are you being bombastic because you've made a calculation? You know what? This person, in order to be pulled back into the path of righteousness so they can experience God's blessing in their life, they need a firm word from me now. And you make a self-controlled decision to say things in a way that might have their jaw drop.
That's a key point. You're saying make a self-controlled decision. You should not be speaking in anger that is not premeditated, that is not tempered. You should have self-control. And I venture to say when Jesus overturned the tables and when he took a whip and whipped a bunch of people in the temple, he was very angry. But I think he had complete and total control over his emotions at the time and his mood at the time.
And I think it's the same on the flip side. We were talking about, that hyper winsome, soft and gentle. And it's like, okay, come on. Would you call out sin, please? Would you speak the truth boldly, please? And sometimes, not always, I think we got to be fair. Like, okay, I don't know everything that's going on in their head. I don't know everything that's going on with their church and their situation. But from an outsider's view, it sure does look like they're being fearful. Like they're afraid to offend. They don't want to chase away big donors from their church, or they don't want to chase away quote unquote seekers who might want to join the church or whatever. So they're ruled by fear. Well, that's not self-control either, right? That's fear controlled. You're controlled by your fear. You're not controlled by the fruit of the Spirit, the Holy Spirit. You're not controlled by God. Mm-hmm. You're controlled by the flesh. And so it's not just anger. It's any and all tones. So we need to catch ourselves. Am I doing this out of fear? Am I doing this out of anger? Am I doing this out of any sort of emotion that has me taking my eye off the ball? I think that's the point. And so I don't know if the young bros would hear this show because you and I are not hip enough for them, Daniel. So I don't, but if they accidentally somehow stumble upon it, you young bros, listen. If you got a pastor who's full of dynamite and fire and brimstone and he's bringing it, probably I'm fine with that, generally speaking, although there
might
be times.
As long as what he's saying really is godly.
Right, but there might be times where I'm not.
I mean, you got somebody like a Stephen Furtick, for example, who's extremely passionate and bombastic and all of that and says very few godly things.
Exactly.
and you got somebody like a Joel Osteen who's very soft-spoken and very polite.
And also says lots of
very, very few godly things, again. So just the tone, I think, is not really what to focus on. It's are they speaking godly things?
So what are they saying? Why are they saying it? And that will help you understand if the tone is appropriate. So keep that in mind. So us old out of touch guys understand you bros and your bro culture. But you got to turn around and have a little fairness and understand where we're coming from, too. You know what I'm saying? We've been around the block. I've been around the block a couple more times than Daniel, that's for sure. Daniel Razzie, I'm Troy Skinner. What's a block? It's a stadia, almost. Anyway, till next week, 167 and a half hours from now. God bless.